All right, well, I have a word on my heart today that I really feel is going to be a great word for us to head into the new year on. And we're going to start off, because it's New Year's, we're going to start off with the icebreaker topic of New Year's resolutions. I didn't make any. Thank you. We're going to show you some New Year's resolution memes for starters today. I can't believe it's been a year since I didn't become a better person. Now, one of the problems with this guy, his goal was too vague. His resolution is to become a better person. What does that mean? Where do you start? How about another one? My New Year's resolution is to stop lying to myself about making lifestyle changes. Okay, now this guy's problem is he just gave up altogether. He's not even going to try. This is a list of all my New Year's resolutions I actually think can happen. Notice it's blank. So this lady does not have any faith in herself at all. And one more. Gym this week, gym next week. I think we showed that slide last year, if I remember right. Anyway, the problem with New Year's resolution, either we don't even attempt to change, or else we have too big of a plan and we start maybe with a bang and fail. Some reasons why we fail at these things is because we're the ones setting the goals. And we don't always have the right goals. We don't always have the wisdom to know what the best goal is. We also try to do it on our own strength, which is a definite plan for failure right there. You need the Lord in everything. And also we try to do it at our own pace, and we're not very good at setting the right kind of pace. There's an example. I'm going to get up every morning at 3 in the morning and pray for 3 hours before I go to work. Okay, that's a little bit too heavy a pace for the average mortal man to keep up for more than one day. So you plan to fail if you plan it at the wrong pace. And before we get into the Bible for today, I wanted to say a couple more things about our pace. There's a saying, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who said it, but I think it's a good one. You can do more in a year than you think you can. But you can do less in one day than you think you can. Less in one day, but more in a year. That's about pacing yourself through the year. When you're making a goal, you got to keep that in mind. Now, you notice I put up here this kind of color scale. Now, the idea behind this color scale is that you want to be in the green area. The green is a good pace to live your life at. If you go too far to the red, you're in overload. It's getting too fast, too hectic. You're trying to do too much. You can't keep that pace up. You got to find yourself back here in the green zone. On the other hand, if you go too far into the blue zone, you're depressed. There's nothing happening. You find it difficult to get up in the morning. You have no goals, no motivation. See what I'm saying? So I'm going to refer to this color scale as we go through some things today. I found a few years ago an example in a book I was reading in Bible school, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what the book was. I'm doing really good with the references to this sermon. I do not remember what book it was or anything, but I just remember this quote. This pastor was finding himself burning out because he was living in the red zone. He was go, 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 do, do, do. And he asked this consultant friend of his to kind of shadow him through his day. And, you know, come with me. Tell me, look at my life. Tell me, what is it I'm doing wrong? Why am I burning out here? What can I change? How can I fix this? And so after a couple of days of shadowing with the guy and following him and his every move throughout the day, The pastor turns to the consultant and says, "So, do you have any advice for me?" And the consultant says, "You're behind in your think time." What even is think time? I never even heard of that one. And he realized that when you're going too fast, too hectic a pace, you don't have time to think about what you're doing. You can start making stupid decisions and doing wrong things because you're not taking time to think. You don't have time to think. You don't have time to process all those thoughts. Similarly, with emotions, which are very related to our thoughts, you don't have time to process the emotions, and those are kind of like food. You know, you have to process your food properly when you're on the go, and you're eating at the drive-thru and choking down the burger on your way to the next thing. Your digestion might get a little off because you need time to process food just the same way you need time to process thoughts and emotions. If not, you're going to puke on somebody or it's not going to go well. You need time to digest the thoughts and the emotions that are happening in your life, and you need some time in order to process those things to get some nutrition, so to speak, out of those experiences, out of those thoughts and feelings. You need to digest them and think about them and feel those feelings a little bit in order to get something good out of that. And then whatever's left can pass on. So we're behind in our think time if we're living too much in the red zone. I also want to show you that there's kind of a current. I put these arrows on here to indicate there's kind of a current in both directions on this scale. When you're right in that sweet spot, living in the green, which I don't think any of us probably ever do, you're good. But there's a pressure almost when you're in this direction to keep going further in this direction. I'm not fast enough. I'm not doing enough. I'm more. And it's hard to turn against that and say, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm gonna have to say no to that. It's very humbling, actually, because you start to get in this pattern of thinking, I can do it. I'm doing it. I'm getting her done. And it's very disappointing to yourself to have to turn back around and say, you know what, I should take a break today. I shouldn't do that. And it's actually difficult to arrange in your schedule to have that sometimes. If you're very hectic, you have to push against that current to get back into a more balanced spot. In the same way over here, if you get so down in this dead zone, there's a pressure pushing you further this way and to turn and say, I'm going to make a goal. I'm going to start something. I'm going to get something done. It's such an uphill fight, and it's very humbling because oftentimes you need somebody to come alongside you and say, hey, let me help you with this. Let me be your accountability guy. If you're not reading the Bible at all, why don't I meet with you and we'll do it together. Like, you need some help to get past the pressure that pushes you to either one of these sides. So I just wanted to be aware of all that stuff, because when we open the Bible here, we're going to be looking at some specific situations and applying this to some Bible stuff. All right, I'm going to call this today the mountain. And thanks for singing a song about the mountains today. We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 9. This is a familiar passage about the transfiguration of Jesus, although it's one I don't think we preach on very often because it's kind of weird. We're not always sure exactly what to make of it. I want you to know one thing about this before we read it. I did not realize it, but this event happens in Jesus' life at a very crucial moment in his ministry. You know, he had that part of his life where he was a child growing up. That's, I guess, one phase of his life. But once he started his ministry, he had a time period where he was gathering disciples, starting to do miracles, starting to do his teachings. And right now, at this point where the transfiguration occurs, this is like, you could call it like a halftime moment in the game. After this, a whole new phase of his ministry begins, and he starts now focusing more on heading to the cross. His mission becomes much more clear and focused on that. He still does miracles. He still does teaching. He still has disciples. But from this point on, he's very focused on the cross. And you'll start to hear him talk about it from here on out. So be aware of that as we read this. It's also in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So I just happened to pick Mark because it's short and sweet. That's what we like about Mark. Reading from Mark chapter 9, starting at verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. So he said something stupid. That's what you do. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So what does this have to do with finding the right pace in life? Simple answer, everything. I'm going to put the little color scale back up there as we continue talking about this. What I want to do here is take a minute to talk about Moses and take a minute to talk about Elijah, because these are the two guys that were chosen to appear with Jesus on the mountain. So why them? So here's some references. I'm just going to talk about Moses, but if you want to look any of these references up, this is where the story is. In Exodus 2, we remember the story where Moses tries to free the people, free God's people, and he's trying to do it kind of like a New Year's resolution. I'm going to do this. I got a goal. I got a plan. In my own strength, I'm going to do this. And, of course, like most of our resolutions, he fails. He ends up killing a guy and has to run for his life. And I can only, you know, imagine this, but as I understand it, as I look at it, I think he ended up in the blue zone. I think he was, when he got to the desert, feeling like a failure, he was no longer living in the palace, royalty in Egypt. He's down living in a tent in the desert. Yes, he's blessed with some people to hang out with. He gets a wife eventually, a family. He's just a shepherd, though. He's a nobody. He lives in the middle of nowhere. And I'm guessing that he was in the blue zone as far as pace of life. I mean, I'm sure shepherding is hard work. I don't know much about it. But I also imagine that there's lots of downtime, a lot of think time as a shepherd, where you're just sitting there watching the sheep, and you get a lot of time to process all those thoughts and feelings that he may have had up till now that he maybe hadn't processed. Anyway, he's there hanging out in the desert, probably at a very low pace in his life. And then remember, he has in Exodus 3, he has the encounter with God on the mountain. He sees the fire on the mountain. He goes to investigate it, and it's the burning bush, and God speaks to him about direction, about goals, about purpose. Here's what I want you to do. I know you're over there in the blue zone feeling like a failure, but I'm going to send you with a job to do, and you're going to have some action, and you're going to be over here more in the red zone. And he does. He has some problems with it, of course, and argues about it, but eventually he goes and he's got a complete lifestyle change. His family relocates to Egypt. And of course, you know, they do free the slaves this time because it's God's power, because it's God's timing, because it's God's plan. And he gets back to this mountain again in Exodus 19. He's leading the people. He's led them out this far. He comes back to that same mountain where he had initially had that encounter with God and initially got his marching orders, so to speak. And from Exodus 19 to 31, Moses spends time on that mountain. He needed it by now. He's been through a lot of adventures. He needs some time to come back to that mountain. And he receives the Ten Commandments. He receives a bunch of other guidelines for the ruling of the nation. He receives all the blueprints for the tabernacle, which is going to be their worship center, and all the guidelines for how to run their worship. He receives all that in Exodus 19 to 31 on the mountain, and then has to eventually go down the mountain and get back to work leading the people, but he has God's goals in mind. He has God's plan in mind, so he knows where and how to lead them. And I don't know, I could maybe take more time to look at his story and find out for sure, but I don't remember any other times when he's on the mountain after this. But he is, in Exodus 33, talks about he is in the habit of often going to the tent of meeting. And that's the place, even though they move on from the mountain and the people move into different parts of the desert and they don't have that mountain experience with God anymore, but he has a tent with him. He has a place where he goes and he meets with God. And that's where he gets his direction from. That's where he redefines his goals and his perspective. May not be a mountain, but it's the same thing, because what we're finding out really is that the mountain stands for God's presence. It represents God's presence. You don't need a mountain to be in God's presence. We were in God's presence this morning in worship, and we're not on a mountain, right? You don't need the mountain, but the mountain is a great metaphor for God's presence, because when you're up on the mountain, there's a little effort involved getting up there, and there's always some effort in our lives required for us to get into God's presence, to clear that time aside, to get into his presence, to focus our minds, to discipline ourselves, to do it, to just get there, is a little bit of work involved in that. But once we get there, then we can encounter his presence. And coming down from there is, even though we don't want to leave maybe, we have some fresh momentum, so it's almost like a downhill. Walking is a little easier after being with him. And after having been up there and seen from his perspective, we have a better vision and a better view as we move into what's next in our life. It says in Exodus 33:11 that during those times when God would meet with Moses in the tent, that God would talk to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. And I don't know of any other spot, maybe there is, in the Bible where someone's spoken to face to face with God like a friend. So Moses has a pretty special relationship with God and is often used to being in his presence. And I love what Moses says in Exodus 33:15-16. He says, "If your presence does not go with us, do not send us." I love that quote. Moses knew something about the value of God's presence. He goes on to say, "What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth, but that your presence is upon us?" If we want to be distinguished by, wow, that guy does a lot of stuff, we can just live here on the red end of things. If we want to be distinguished by, boy, that guy doesn't do anything, we can live on the blue end of things. But if we want to be be distinguished kind of as a mediocre person. We can live in the green zone. But if we want to be distinguished as people of his presence, we got to spend some time on the mountain. You see, the cool thing about this, just like on the diagram here, we can live our lives on the color scale, never really find our way, never really find the right balance. But we can choose something different. We can choose to spend our life on the mountain, spend our time in God's presence, let our life be marked by that, and not be run by anything else. Moses knew God's presence was the key to his success and to their success as a people. Now, a couple things about Elijah. His story is in 1 Kings 17 through 19. Why would he be picked to be up on the mountain? Well, in 1 Kings 17, just to give you the scenario, his country was involved in a civil war, basically split in half. There was government corruption, religious corruption, 3 years of drought and famine. Things were very stressful. The pace of his life may not have been like super hectic. I'm not sure. It sounds like the pace of his life during those years was slower. And yet, I think his stress level was over in the red, probably, just because he's dealing with all the spiritual warfare and drought and famine and watching his nation be torn apart. He lives with that for 3 years. And then in 1 Kings 18, there's this great spiritual battle over the fate of the nation, and Elijah stands up against 400 priests of Baal, and God enables Elijah to win that contest. But that's a huge spiritual battle. It takes a lot out of him. Probably the 3 years leading up to that had taken a lot out of him too, but he shows up, he makes it happen. God wins the battle through him. But after that battle, sometime after it, in 1 Kings 19, Elijah runs for his life. Sounds familiar. Moses did that. Finds himself deep in the blue zone again, totally burnt out. He kind of went from high to low pretty fast. Now, in that chapter, God gets Elijah physically recharged and he calls him to the mountain. I'll just say this as a bonus. Sometimes when you're feeling burnt out, all you really need is a good meal and a good night's sleep, and your perspective is a lot better. So God starts there with him, gives him some food, lets him rest physically, but then he calls him to the mountain. Elijah journeys to the mountain and spends a night in a cave, some cave time. I'm going to read a few verses out of 1 Kings 19. And the word of the Lord came to him. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too." Now it's interesting, I think, he's pouring out his heart. He had some emotions to process. Do you notice that? He's processing this out loud in prayer to the Lord. And that's the best way to do it. But notice that God doesn't, this is verse 11 of chapter 19, God doesn't even respond to what he just said. You know, if I was God, I would have said, "Oh man, I'm so sorry, you've been through so much." You know, or I would acknowledge what he said there. It was a pretty big statement. But instead, the Lord says, go out of the cave, come out of that blue zone, so to speak, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord. There it is again. The mountain is the symbol for the presence of the Lord. For the Lord is about to pass by. He doesn't even answer anything Elijah says. He just says, "Go out, get in my presence. That's what you need. I could counsel you. I could talk to you all day long. What you really need, get in my presence." And then the story we probably all have heard before, then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Elijah knew the voice of the Lord when he heard it. It came in a gentle whisper. And here's the thing. When you're all wound up in the red zone somewhere, you're probably not going to hear the gentle whisper. You got to somehow get on that mountain. Somehow get yourself to that mountain so you can hear what God has to say. Now, it's interesting that Elijah, in that passage I just read, Elijah tells God where he's been personally. Here's what's been happening, Lord. But God tells Elijah where he's going. And that's one of the great values of this mountain, of being in God's presence. We can spend time telling God where we've been. We can process those emotions with him. That's one great part of our prayer lives. We can get it all off our chest, so to speak. But it's wonderful that God can tell us where we're going. We can see more from his perspective when we're up on the mountain in his presence, and he can tell us where we're going. And that's what happened with Elijah. By the way, this is the same mountain that Moses was on. Did I say that? Not a coincidence, I don't think. It was about, I think, if I remember right, I think it was about 600 years after Moses that Elijah was on that mountain. Anyway, Elijah had felt burnout. Elijah had felt like he was done. He had actually prayed, God, take me. I'm ready to die. I'm done with this thing. That's how burnt out he was. But on the mountain, God says, okay, here's what I want you to do. And all of a sudden, he's got reason to live. He's got plans. He's got goals. He's got momentum. And he says, here's what I want you to do. Go anoint this guy as king over this place. Go anoint this guy as king over this place. Go pick this guy here. He's going to be your successor. You're going to spend the next season of your life working with these guys. And like all of a sudden, wow, a couple seconds on the mountain, and I've got a whole new perspective. I've got a whole new life plan. It wasn't my goal, which would have failed, and it's not my strength, which would have failed. It's God's plan and God's strength. It all comes from being on the mountain. So Moses and Elijah are both guys who very much understand the value of being on the mountain, and it was something that Moses, like I said, he walked it out in the years that followed that mountaintop experience. He walked it out by often meeting with God face to face in that tent. And Elijah, we don't know a lot about how he did it in his life, but Elijah is one of two guys in the Old Testament who didn't have to die. They were taken directly from earth to heaven. Enoch was the first one in Genesis chapter 5. And if you read about Enoch, it says he walked with God. And that really strikes me for several reasons. One is walking is not running. That's a pace. That's a pace you can keep up. There may be moments when God says, run, run with me here. But most of the time, we're asked to walk with God, and we're asked to be still and know that I am God. I can't think of a place when it says, run, Forrest, run. I can't think of one. Maybe there is one, but there's a pace here, and God's pace may be slower than what you think. So I don't know. They don't say Elijah walked with God, I don't think, in the same way they said Enoch walked with God. But yet, those are the only two guys that ever got taken directly from earth to heaven. So something in me associates those two together, and I'm thinking, Did Elijah walk so closely with God after this? Did he walk so much in God's presence? That's a very great word picture, walking with God. If you picture the presence right next to you every step of the way, the intimacy, the relationship that happens there, not taking a step on your own and leaving God behind, not lagging behind yourself and letting him lose you somehow, staying just in step with him. Like it says in the New Testament, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Great picture. And I think it's true of Elijah. I think he walked with God, and that's why God took him, that intimate relationship. God, he was so interested in God's presence, so familiar with God's presence. It was just like one day he's walking on earth in God's presence, and the next day, whoops, I'm in heaven with God's presence. It's all the same. I just was in God's presence the whole time. Didn't even notice. So, of course, we have to say something about Jesus here before we bring this to an application. I want to read a couple of verses from Luke's version of the Transfiguration because we learned something more about Jesus in Luke 9 that Mark did not tell us. It says in Luke 9, verse 28, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. For some reason, Mark didn't tell us they went up there to pray. Verse 29, as he was praying, that's when the Transfiguration happened. And I think that's very valuable. We're using the mountain as a symbol for being in his presence, but how do we get in his presence? Basically, prayer is the main thing. And I was encouraged to hear it mentioned already a couple of times in the service as such an important thing. And I think we can think of the year 2018 as a year where God is calling us to more prayer, a closer walk with him, more frequent conversations with him. You can look at Moses, who often went to that tent of meeting to meet with the Lord. You can look at Elijah, who I think walked with God every day. And Jesus is no exception to that. These three guys are all about God's presence. In Luke 5:16, or starting at verse 15, it says the news spread about Jesus all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and be healed of their sicknesses. Jesus was living in more of a red zone at this point in his life. People wanted to see him. Everywhere he went, he couldn't get away from it. There was demands on him. People wanted to be healed. People wanted to hear his teachings. And it says in Luke 5:16, but even though those demands were there, even though the pace was hectic, in verse 16 of Luke 5, it says, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Often withdrew. Remember, you're on that scale. You're going. I'm not going to go anymore. I'm going to go pray. It doesn't seem to make sense when you're on that treadmill to stop and pray, and yet that's what Jesus did often, any chance he got. And in John 5:19, another key verse about how related to God's presence Jesus was, he says in John 5:19, very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees the Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. So what we're learning here is Jesus was not setting his own goals. Jesus was not planning his own itinerary every day. He was often going to the Father and saying, what do I do? What do we do next? Where are we going next, Father? Often in touch with God's presence for the direction and for the encouragement he needed. And in this particular case, on this mountain, as he's heading in this great turning point of his life, he's arrived. He's got his ministry going. He's got all his disciples. He's got the crowds following him. He did everything he needed to do with miracles and teachings. But now he comes aside to the mountain. He feels the call to go aside, not just for a quick lonely place to pray, but something a little bit bigger. He goes away to the mountain. And he hears these words, "This is my son whom I love." That relationship is what we encounter in his presence. That relationship is what strengthens us to go do the stuff that he's going to call us to do when we're also on that mountain. He gives us not only the goals, but the encouragement and the relationship and love. Isn't it interesting that when he started his ministry, Jesus, when he was baptized, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." He needed to hear that to get him started. That gave him strength. Knowing his dad was with him, he got to this point in his ministry and he's turning his face to the cross and like, oh boy, I got this far, but this next half is going to be harder than the first half for sure. He needed to hear that again. "This is my son whom I love." You need to go to the mountain sometimes to hear from your father, to hear how he loves you, to be encouraged in your relationship with him. So as we head into this new year, we want to apply this to our lives today. We need God's presence. I can say it just that simply. We don't need to make our own goals. We don't need to live in our own strength. We don't need to make New Year's resolutions and try to fix everything and figure everything out. We just need God's presence. If we get in God's presence often in prayer, and I'll put that up there. Ding. It's going to be a good year if we do that. Because God will call us to do things more amazing than things we would have invented on our own if we just spend time with him. In God's presence, it's where we can process our thoughts and emotions with him so we can stay healthy in that way. It's where we can be strengthened and encouraged by our relationship and by his love. It's where we can receive fresh perspective on life, receive fresh goals, direction, momentum. And remember, we don't need a mountain, physical mountain. "Oh, I can't pray. I don't have a mountain. I'll have to do that some other day when I can find a mountain." Just withdraw somewhere to a lonely place and pray. Maybe it's your shower in the morning. Maybe it's the drive to work. Anywhere you can find it. You know, wasn't it Brother Lawrence who wrote that book, Practicing the Presence of God? Walking with him every step of the day. Withdrawing is one way, any quiet moment you can get. But just walking with him and talking to him throughout the day, like it says in the New Testament, pray continuously. It's a lifestyle. I'm not going to give you a plan today to suggest to you that you have to pray 5 minutes a day or 10 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day or half an hour a day or an hour a day or anything. I'm not going to tell you times. I'm just going to tell you often and continuously seek his presence. Seek his presence and do it through prayer. There's many kinds of prayer. Like I said, worship is a form of prayer. Thanking him. Just thinking about how great he is. You can do that. Put on some worship music in your car and just start connecting with him. Pouring out your needs, pouring out your hurts, your problems. That's another part of our prayer life. Pour it out to him. Don't let everyone else hear it. Let him hear it. He can best handle it. He can best tell you what to do with it. There's other forms of prayer that are more like warfare, when you need to really fight for someone or for something. And there's the prayer that is just silent and listening. Listening for that gentle whisper. And this is not a teaching on prayer, but that's just a quick glimpse of how many different forms of prayer there are. All right, if I can have some music. What we're going to do here to bring things to a close is we're going to take about 3 minutes And I'm gonna ask you to do this, okay? I'm gonna ask you to take about the first minute and a half. I'll get my stopwatch out for those people who are totally in the red zone and they can't stand one more second. I'm gonna time it. Don't worry. We'll only take about 3 minutes. I want you to experience that 3 minutes is enough to totally change something in your life. Because God's presence is not about time. In His presence, it's always now. It's always eternity. He can do something in split second that would take you a billion years to figure out. He can whisper something to you that'll be totally guide your entire year, totally keep you on focus. And I want you to experience that this morning. And I'm asking Him to come meet with us right now. We're going to give you about a minute and a half. I want you to talk to Him, for starters, about maybe about this past year, stuff you've been carrying around. Boy, this was hard this year. Boy, thank you for that. This happened this year. Anything that's on your heart that comes to your heart, process that stuff. Get it out. Get it off your chest. Talk to Him about it, good or bad. And then after about a minute and a half, I'll ask you to quiet your heart and try to stay just silent in His presence for about a minute and a half. And I'm trusting during that time you will hear, not with your ears, but somehow in your heart, you'll hear a gentle whisper of the Lord telling you something that you need to hear for this year coming up, okay? Timing is starting now. Begin quieting your hearts now for the rest of the time to just hear from Him. Lord, we thank you for your presence. We thank you for Jesus dying for us, shedding his blood to make that presence of God available to us 24/7. And we thank you for your church, Lord, where when we gather together, we feel your presence even in a more special way sometimes. But we pray for everyone individually in this place that this will be a year marked by your presence, a year marked by often retreating to your presence, a year marked by walking in your presence, Lord. Help us with that, Lord. Help us with that simple goal, Lord. More of your presence in our lives, Lord. More of your presence, Lord, on our jobs, Lord. More of your presence in our homes, Lord. More of your presence in our families, in our marriages, Lord. More of your presence everywhere we go, Lord. More of your presence in this church and in everything we do here at PCF, Lord. More of your presence. More of your presence. Like Moses said, Lord, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us. We need your presence.